The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Joining me on the program today is somebody who's been on the coronavirus since its inception. He is the proprietor of Peak Prosperity and the author of two best-selling books, The Crash Course and Prosper, Chris Martinson, who joins me now. Chris, I want to begin with every single year, we have 30 to 60,000 people that die every year from the flu virus, depending on whether it's a normal or heavier normal season. What makes the coronavirus different from those that preceded it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the first thing to understand is that that estimate, 30 to 60,000 people who die, is really, it's just an estimate. There's no actual counting of that. And this is something that happens with, you know, people who are immunocompromised, the very young, the very old. When they get ill, sometimes things go bad, and either their immune system can't handle the virus and they're overwhelmed by it, or more likely, they have an underlying condition that leads to their demise. So what's different here is that there's a couple things we need to know. The first is that with the flu, every year when it comes around, some people get it, some don't, because we've all been exposed to the flu before. It's some new version of H this and that or something like that, and there's influenza A and B and all that stuff, right? But we've seen it before as a species. So as a herd, if you talk about people like animals, as a herd, we have herd immunity. Some people are going to be fully immune to that thing that comes around and some won't. And so without the herd immunity, which is what we have in this case, nobody has any ability to fight it off, so that if anybody is exposed to this new novel coronavirus, they're going to get it. And then the second thing is how easily it spreads. And there's a way to measure that. The technical term is R-naught. But what that's really asking and answering is this question. On average, if I have the flu, how many people would I pass it to? And the answer to that is 1.28. And for this novel coronavirus, the answer is somewhere between 2.5 and 6, depending on the kinds of controls that we have in place. So it's way more infective. It jumps really easily, spreads really easily. And then the third thing that's really tricky about it is that it can spread during what's called the asymptomatic phase, meaning I've gotten exposed. It's replicating in my body. I don't have any symptoms yet. I've got no fever, got no chills, I've got no muscle aches, I have nothing like that. But it's in my body and it's shedding from my body, so I'm passing it to others. And so those things make this very different from the flu as well. A subtle thing, but maybe not that subtle. This coronavirus survives on surfaces for hours to days, where flu survives for minutes to most hours. So it really is very persistent and can land on a doorknob, a handle, a banister, and sit there for days, you know, waiting to be picked up by somebody. So you put all of that together, and it comes back down to the final thing we need to talk about here, which is that the complication rate that comes off of this is vastly higher than for flu. And so for flu, somewhere in the vicinity of somewhere under 1% of the people who really come down with a bad case of the flu will end up in the hospital with complications. But with the coronavirus, from what we know so far, it's about 15%. Now, that number might come down when we actually do, you know, full testing and we get a fuller sense of it. But for now, that's the number we seem to have at present. So a lot of people end up in the hospital. It ends up swamping the hospital. And then when you get it, this is the worst part. So somebody who gets it, typically, you know, your symptoms start day one of the symptoms starting. By day 8, it's either going to start to resolve or you're going to go down the other path. And if you go down that other path, which is very bad, you then go down the critical path. And you end up in the ICU, and you might be there for up to 21 days on average. That's the average stay now, on a ventilator, all that. And if you're going to survive, you're going to be there for 21 days. So that really separates it from the flu in all kinds of ways. Spreads easily. We've never seen it. It's really got a very bad serious complication rate, and it's just a beast of a sickness when you get it. Way worse than the flu people are describing for a lot of them.
We know that usually during the flu season, eventually the virus burns itself out with warmer weather. Do we know if that would apply to the coronavirus at this point?
You know, Jim, I was hoping that was going to be the case. And I kept that as a hope. And today I was running across the case figures coming out of Guayaquil in Ecuador. And it's really running rampant down there. And that is a place that has what I consider to be summer temperatures, at least for up here in Massachusetts. They're in the 80s and 90s with 70%+ humidity. So it's spreading very easily and very rapidly down there right now. So I'm not as hopeful as I used to be that we're going to get what's called a summer pause. But even if we had a pause, even the flu doesn't go away entirely in summer. It just doesn't spread quite as easily. We don't have enough data on this one yet. You know, gosh, we didn't, wasn't spreading through Brazil as quickly as we thought. You know, for some reason hasn't gone into Africa like we might have expected. So that gave hope that there would be the summer pause. But now we're starting to see it catch on and spread in places like I just mentioned.
Chris, explain the difference between DNA and RNA in relation to viruses.
Well, sure. DNA, everybody's familiar with that. That's the deoxyribonucleic acid that sits in the center of every one of our cells. And RNA is just ribonucleic acid, and it's just a slightly different chemical configuration. And RNA is what our cells use as the messenger that takes the message of the DNA, carries it out into the cell body so it can be the message that's then read and turned into all the things we need in our cells to live. All the various proteins get translated from that. So in this case, what this virus is doing, this coronavirus, it has a strand of positive sense RNA, meaning you read the RNA forwards like normal, and that's what contains its entire instructional package. It's just under 20,000 base pairs, so it's not a big piece, not a big message, but it's enough to do a tremendous amount of damage. That RNA is in the center of that virus. It's contained in a really very complex sort of a capsule that has all the docking instructions and everything. And when that docks with a cell, it gets brought into the cell, and then that RNA is released into the cell, where the cell is tricked into manufacturing more and more copies of that virus. So the RNA is the messenger that is bringing that message into the cell.
I want to talk about not only coronavirus, but Chris, recently with H1N1, we've gone through SARS, MERS, Ebola. It doesn't seem like the healthcare system was prepared for something like a pandemic like COVID-19.
It really wasn't. And that's a failure to plan. That wasn't a failure of imagination. That wasn't because smart people couldn't envision this. Sci-fi writers have written books that tracked this remarkably closely. Even the Netflix series Contagion, it followed along exactly the same plot line. So we've always known the plot line, which is this. When you have a major pandemic, you have a virus that ticks a number of boxes. And some of the biggest, most important boxes are, it just did a species to human jump. And that's critical because when you come out of a species, in this case, probably a bat, might have gone through a snake or a pangolin, we don't know what it went through next, comes into humans. That means that no humans have been exposed to it. So that's checkbox one. Ding. Checkbox two that you need to have is it needs to spread easily and survive well outside of the host. Check, check. Got both of those. And then you, it's going to have some serious complication to it. I mean, you know, if it's something like a virus that we might get, which is almost entirely asymptomatic, who would care, right? In fact, there are viruses that exist within and around us that are like that. But this one causes very serious complications. And so that, you know, all of these things should have been setting off alarm bells very early on. I sent out my first alert on January 23rd. I was tracking this thing for a week beforehand. And then when China put the quarantine around Wuhan, I said, uh-oh, China doesn't care about human lives. I know enough about them to know that if they're willing to shut down an important vital manufacturing center with 11 million people, that's all I need to know. This thing must be really bad. I didn't know how bad yet, but I knew it checked all the checkboxes for being a pandemic virus, and I knew how China was responding. That was good enough, and that's when I first became concerned.
You know, one of the things that there's been some comparisons to the Spanish flu in 1918, and back then, Chris, we don't have communication and instantaneous news like we have now. We've had far more medical advances since then. But unlike back then, today you have more travel, so you can get on an airplane and go anywhere. And we also have demographic density, which makes it easier to transmit. I wonder if you'd contrast 1918 to 2020.
Sure. You know, there's so many remarkable parallels. The first is, back in 1918, there were some real heroes, people who were willing to be leaders, make very unpopular decisions, canceling gatherings, limiting, big sort of assemblages and things like that. And there were knuckleheads who just didn't believe this whole thing, were slow to the game, and, you know, advised everybody not to panic. And we see that same thing today. You know, there's a bunch of knuckleheads out there, and then there are people who take it seriously, and there's a big gap in countries and how countries are responding to this. Some are doing really well at it, others not so much. So I'm really heartened by the fact that we do have this information now. It's possible, you know, for myself, I put out these video series. I've received messages literally from almost every country in the world from people saying thank you, people who are able to hear the message. So yes, good messaging can get out there. I'm really heartened watching all these people do super creative things, Jim, with making face masks in the face of a worldwide personal protective equipment and face mask shortage. people are home cottage industry sewing and sharing patterns and figuring out what's the best type of material to use and how would you decontaminate them and which materials have better functions in terms of being allowing you to breathe, but also stopping the virus and all that. So that's where the information is working for us, working against us are the two things you mentioned, the density of people that we have crammed in, 70% of people in cities now. And as well, there are still, if you go to flighttracker.com and look it up, there are thousands of planes in the air right now. Every one of them, guaranteed, a lot of them are carrying virus around from point to point. So you have that. And then the third thing, really big, and I've been telling everybody, Jim, plant a garden, because one of the things that's really different then and now, in 1918, still most people lived on a farm or could go back to a farm. Today, that's absolutely not true. It's the exact opposite. So I'm a little worried about what's going to happen, particularly with vegetable production this year, because it's very labor intensive and that requires people to move. And that didn't happen, is not happening during critical planting season. So for a variety of reasons, not just because maybe a food insufficiency, but I think people, you know, you should get outside, have a garden, give you something to do, and could be important to help add to the food supply. And that's an important message I like to carry out in this whole thing, Jim, is that we all have a role to play in this. This isn't the government failing us, and you know, and it did. It absolutely did by failing to have PPE ready for us all and for the healthcare system particularly. But now that we're here, you know, we can't wait for the government to do anything because they're not gonna, and they can't. And so I do think that we all have a role to play in making sure we're all wearing masks, that we're all wearing gloves, that we're all using appropriate social distancing, that we're modifying our behaviors so that we're not spreading this thing as much as possible. And we're going to have a role to play, I think, in feeding ourselves too, that could be really beneficial and helpful to the nation.
One of the things, as you mentioned earlier, Chris, is coronavirus is asymptomatic. You know, as you mentioned, in the early stages, you don't know you even have it, even though you might be spreading it. So they talk about social distancing, staying at home, which we're doing now. Now, the government has been using figures, safe distance of 6 feet. You think it's much larger than that, like 12 or even three times that. Explain that.
Yeah, so this is a big debate that raged for a while. But we had early data, and by early, I mean late January. China was already talking about how this virus was airborne. And so let's get a couple of distinctions out here. So when we talk about how this virus might spread, one is by droplets. And a droplet is something that's over 5 microns in size. It's, you know, you could, in a bright light, you know, it's floating around, you could see this thing. And that's how big 5 microns is. If it's smaller than that, then this thing can float around in the air for a long time. And then we might say that it's aerosolized, right? So it's a droplet that's so small, it doesn't settle to the floor, and now it's floating about. And China gave early indications that that was the case. And then there's another distinction, which might be airborne, meaning that this is just the pure shed virus particle all on its own, traveling around without like being encased in water. And that's a whole different thing. It looks like this thing is aerosolized. And so China gave us that data, and then we had good data early, I'd say probably February 5th or 6th was the first time I saw this. Singapore, which has been doing just an incredible job with all this, they actually went around and tested 3 different hospital rooms of patients who had had this thing, and they swabbed all the rooms before and after cleaning and checked 18 different surfaces, knobs, floors, air vents. They discovered this stuff everywhere, and it was in the air vents too, and that was all I needed to know to say that this thing's floating around, and it floats around pretty easily. If you need to be just 1 meter away, which is what the WHO was recommending as of March 28th, which is ridiculous, that means it's just only traveling by really heavy droplets. 2 meters thinks it's traveling by slightly smaller droplets, but if you think there's a chance that it's traveling by these aerosolized pieces, then there's an MIT study that came out just a couple days ago, said that's how it's traveling. So we have U.S. confirmation of both the Singapore and the Chinese data. It says if that's the case, you need to be as much as 6 meters away from other people. So, you know, 18 to 20 feet, right? Because it's really traveling around. And as well, we had the Chinese telling us that if somebody was in an elevator before you, and then you get in and you relax your standards, because you're like, oh, there's nobody else in here with me, and you pull your mask down, that's when you could get infected too, because it might still be hanging in the air. And by the way, it hangs in the air for up to 3 hours, according to the MIT study and according to some other studies we've seen. So yeah, it's small, it travels around, it's very persistent. I've been calling it jokingly the honey badger virus, because the honey badger is an escape artist, very difficult animal to contain, very, very tenacious. This thing survives great outside of the host, It travels around in really small particles. And it's for that reason, everybody needs to wear a mask, because you don't want the asymptomatic or symptomatic people to be spreading this thing in the first place. Because once it's out in the air, now you got to prevent people from getting it in their eyes. Now you got to wipe down all the surfaces with Clorox. You got to do all that stuff. Why not catch it at the mouth and nose before it comes out?
You know, you bring up a good point, because when the early stages this came out, the government was saying you don't need to wear a mask. The mask is for people that either have it or for healthcare workers. But what you just brought up, you could walk into an elevator where somebody was coughing and sneezing. It's hovering in the air. You have no idea. And the only way to protect yourself would be wearing a mask.
Well, it's absolutely correct. This is going to be one of the, when the books are written afterwards, this is going to be one of the largest health policy disasters ever, was the government suggesting, recommending. We had the Surgeon General saying masks don't work. We had CDC officials explaining that if normal, ordinary people try and use a mask, they might do more harm than good. All complete poppycock. They were saying that because here's what they didn't want to say, Jim. They didn't want to say, look, we failed to plan for this thing. We failed to stockpile PPE. There isn't enough for both healthcare workers and everybody else to have some. So we'd like to preserve what we have left for the healthcare workers. Instead of being honest and coming through the front door, they tried to shame everybody into thinking that they were too stupid to wear a mask, or that it wouldn't help, or that they were stealing something that healthcare workers needed more than them. And now, Jim, when we get to the point of the story where they're going to realize that, yeah, the only way we can get back to work in this country or any country is if one of the most critical things you could do. You said, Chris, only one thing. You only get one policy measure. It would be have to have everybody wear a mask. And of course, there are other things we'd want to do too, but that's the cornerstone. It starts there. And now they're going to have to undo all of that programming, all of that bad messaging that they put out, and start explaining, oh no, actually masks do work. And that's where they've lost the trust. They've really eroded the faith in the institutions. It's just never a good idea to lie about something like that. That's what they did. And really unfortunate from a health policy standpoint. And really, I think Strauss and Howe, from a fourth turning standpoint, would say, that's going to really accelerate that fourth turning aspect, where the erosion of faith in institutions is a hallmark of that. That was a really bad, bad decision on their part to try and run the whole masks don't work story.
I want to go on, and speaking of masks, there's two Israeli companies, Sanovia and Argamon Technologies, that are coming out with copper-infused masks, and then also there's copper-infused gloves. Chris, explain the role that copper has as an antibacterial.
Well, it works as both as an antibacterial and an antiviral. So the copper itself, I believe that the technology of those companies are using nanoparticles, so very, very tiny particles of copper. And so at that level, if a virus particle or a bacteria comes in contact with that copper, the charge on the surface of that copper basically ruins them, just takes them apart. So there's some metals that do that. Silver is another one. And copper turns out to be pretty good and relatively cheap in this story. That feels like a really good idea. I mean, I've read some of the press releases from that, and I know that they say you can wash these things 100 times. I think they tested them without any loss of efficacy. So, yeah, I'm really hopeful that we can get stuff like that. But let me be clear, in the absence, if people can't get their hands on those, anything is better than nothing. Even a bandana is 50% effective in this story. Would we rather be 99% effective? Yes. But if we can't, you know, just use whatever we have at this point in time, and, you know, a double layered t-shirt, you know, cut that up and put it around. That'll work. I know people are using vacuum cleaner bags, which are, you know, HEPA rated and as good as an N95 mask if you can fit it properly, sewn in between layers of cotton. There's all kinds of things people can do, but this is just to get us back to the point where companies like the ones you just mentioned, or the good old standard N95 masks, become available once again, which they will. But everybody should wear a mask for their own benefit, and for everybody else's benefit.
I want to talk about a possible hope, and we've heard about hydroxychloroquine. I just read an article today. There's a doctor in New York who's had almost 700 patients with a 100% success rate with hydroxychloroquine. I think it's Z-Pak, zinc, or something. What about that as a possible solution?
I'm hopeful. I read that, and I read that article about that doctor and the 699 patients in probably seven different news outlets. And what I couldn't find, what I wanted to find was, I wanted to see the base data. And so there are a lot of people making claims, and I'm very hopeful too. I do think there is something to hydroxychloroquine. The Chinese said there is. The Indians are using it. India is using it right now as a prophylactic for their healthcare workers. Russia's had some success with it. So we've seen a lot of success with it. So I'm hopeful. But what I want to see is how do we know these were COVID patients? Were they all tested positive? How old were they? Did they have any other? Because hydroxychloroquine, there's a couple of drugs you wouldn't want to take in conjunction with. It's got some side effects. So, you know, there's just some stuff I'd like to know. So I couldn't find a follow-up to that, but I'm hopeful around that. But here's the thing that he's doing there that is essential. It's including the zinc. The Z-Pak, the azithromycin, I'm not sure if that has any direct effect on anything regarding the virus at this point. That's possibly just a prophylactic against secondary bacterial infection. But hydroxychloroquine, it's an ionophore. It helps to open up the pores between cells so that the cells can share different ions. One of those that's really important to stopping the viral replication is zinc. You need the zinc inside the cell. The zinc is outside the cell. How do you get it inside the cell? Well, hydroxychloroquine helps with that process. And so that's a fairly well-known molecular process at this point. And there are other things too that people, you know, I'm taking zinc right now myself, not medical advice, but I'm taking it. As well as there are some other things that can help bring that into the cell as well that are natural things that quercetin, you know, the elderberry extracts and even strong green teas have compounds in them that also help that process. So I think that when we finally get through and sort through all of the data and we find out why did this person have a really bad case, why did this person not have a bad case, we might find that it has something to do with people's zinc levels, selenium levels, you know, their diet. There'll be some things that will work out like that. But right now, we're operating with kind of imperfect information, but we're starting the dots are starting to gel, and we're starting to see a picture here.
I want to go on to something you've written on your site and you've made available to people that sign up, and that's the survival guide at Peak Prosperity. Chris, spend a few moments and talk about some essentials that you put together out of that survival guide.
Sure. So, you know, here we all are in lockdown and quarantine, right? Which is a really stressful time for a lot of people. And you know, this is going to be, honestly, Jim, one of the things that I worry about the most is how people are going to come through any of this emotionally and what they're going to have to do to really survive a big, long lockdown like this. So in this guide, we're talking about all the different things that people can and should think about, everything from the health aspects of this, what they're going to need to think about in terms of, you know, keeping a green zone in your house. How do you keep your house clean? What kind of disinfectants should you get? How do you run through masks? And how would you disinfect masks if you really wanted to do that, which I think we all are going to have to talk about how we would do that. As well, we talk about, you know, this is going to be really hard for people economically. So there's a lot of things people should be thinking about there as well. It's just such a long list of things that we've been talking about that, you know, people need to consider at this point in time. So I would advise people take a look at that. It's got a lot of great advice in there. I think Adam Taggart put a lot of time and effort into that. And it's really just collecting, I don't know how much data we have on our site now around this, but it impacts everything. Your finances, your health, you know, your emotional state, all kinds of things.
I want to move on to something that follows this, and that's, let's talk about financial impacts of this. I'm writing a piece for my clients right now called The End of Money. And right now, the market is worried about deflation. But if we've seen what the Fed has done, including recently going into the corporate bond market, we watch the credit markets very closely. One of the things that is going to come out of this, and let's talk about something the markets are not ready and most people are not ready for, and that is the return of inflation.
Yeah, this is something I think is coming sooner than most people realize. The base setup is this. We do have a lot of deflation in the system right now. We had a lot of unnecessary debt in the system. We had, 16% of all companies were zombie companies. The definition is that their operating income flows were not sufficient to meet their debt interest payments, so they needed to continue to roll and tap credit markets, which are now shredded. We have, of course, all the destruction happening in the oil business right now, particularly in the shale space. A lot of deflation there, a lot of debts going belly up. We had record amounts of BBB corporate debt, which is all in the process of getting downgraded at this point in time. We have millions of companies in China that are out of cash. So these are all very deflationary things. Against that, that story sums into this, though. You're going to have fewer companies producing things. So that's less stuff. That's macro story one. Macro story two is trillions of dollars of just straight stimulus is being printed out of thin air and handed out, right? And I don't think $1,200 a person is going to even get close to covering the hole that just got created here. And so, but still, it's very, very large amounts of money. And I think it's just the start. This $2 trillion stimulus bill, I'll be surprised if they're not doubling and tripling it within months at this stage. So we're going to have all this printing, huge amounts of money going against what? What are people going to buy with it, right? Less stuff. Lots of inflation should result.
So classic, more money chasing fewer goods, higher prices. Let's talk about the role of government here, because this is unusual in the sense that typical recessions that we've seen in the past, they've been induced by higher interest rates with the Fed raising or oil shock. This one is a sort of medical shock, and the government is creating this hole. You know, you mentioned the word stimulus. I don't see this as stimulus. I feel this as an attempt to fill a deep, vast hole they just created.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Let's use our terms, right? So it's not really stimulus. There are, and I know personally, dozens of people who are out of work at this point in time, just the light switch got flicked off. They don't know how they're going to make rent. They don't know how they're going to make mortgage payments. They don't know how they're going to pay for cars. They have all this. It was as if all of our lives were in flow. We had this flow of credit and money going through the system, and it just stopped. So you can throw $1,200 at somebody, but if that covers, you know, a third of your mortgage payment, that doesn't really help much. It buys you a week or two, right? So that's what I think they're up against here. And I this is the part that's going to be very hard for people to get their head around, and something I've been trying to write about and communicate, is that I think this virus has now, and this pandemic, is the signature event that's going to change people's lives. Just like, I remember my grandmother, she came through the Depression. She would still save the string off of pot roast in a ball because you couldn't waste anything. It was that formative for her. Well, this is another formative event that's coming forward. And because of that, consumer behaviors are going to change, how they travel, how they associate, whether they save or spend, their willingness to take on risk, what they consider to be of value. Everything is going to change, I think, because of this. And there'll be winners and losers around all of this. But the idea that the Fed can print some money, get stocks back up to highs, and somehow we just skate past this is pure fantasy thinking at this point, as far as I'm concerned.
As we look at the typical investments, you know, you have portfolios, you have part stocks, part bonds. As I look at this, Chris, at the levels of debt, and you talked about stimulus, we think they'll go through two or three. In fact, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, on the day you and I are doing this, is to hold a press conference. They're already working on stimulus package two. God knows how many trillions that's going to be. So we are going to be adding trillions and trillions of money creation, getting that to people. And as you mentioned, there are going to be a lot of companies that go under. So there's going to be fewer companies making stuff with more money chasing it. Let's talk about the investment implications, because it seems to me this favors tangibles, things like precious metals, things like real estate, in certain cases, stocks. I would say the right kind of stocks.
Yeah, so absolutely. I think this is back to real wealth. And so listen, the larger framework I operate from, and I think you might share some of this, is that a lot of what we have was just a fantasy. It was financialization. It was using money to make money and leverage and speculation. It wasn't investing, right? Where investing is calculating a risk and seeing what the value add is and understanding that there's a return. And so a lot of that'll come back in vogue again. In the meantime, what do you do? And so I'll tell you what I've done. I moved heavily into real estate early this year, closing on a couple of properties. I just got right under the nick of time here in January, managed to do that. And already I see the effect of that, because I'm up here. I'm about 3 hours away from New York City. And right now, all these places where there used to be summer homes here are actually full of New Yorkers. Because guess what? People have decided they'd rather not be in a city, not a hot spot. And I think that's going to portend a kind of a permanent change where people de-cityize and say, don't want to be there, and would rather not be there, a pandemic or no. I think there's this realization that cities are vulnerable in certain ways. And so for the people who can, there's going to be a lot of money exiting cities saying, you know what, I wouldn't mind to have a place that has a place where I could garden a little, maybe be further away from people, so I can practice whatever social isolation feels right to me. And once you turn that crank, Jim, I don't think there's no unturning it, right? I think people, are going to make that. It's going to take. I can't imagine how people just do that and then wander back into cities because the pandemic's gone, right? This virus is now with us. It's not, that genie's not going back in the bottle, and it's going to be something that we're going to deal with for a very long time, barring, getting some miracle vaccine that's super efficacious, right? So might happen, but we can't plan on that for now. So I think that's going to happen. And I think as well, we're going to see people start to understand the difference between making money by adding value to products and services and making money using money. I think that story is really broken. That's what the Fed's been really bailing out. I mean, I'm sure all your listeners know the Fed's been actively bailing out major hedge funds, major speculators, banks that got upside down on really bizarre, very sophisticated, esoteric things that most people wouldn't understand if you explained it 10 times kind of stuff, including me, right? That's broken now, and the Fed's busy trying to unbreak it, but I don't think it can be unbroken. So then we get back to, where does all this big money in the world go? And right now, I'm pretty tightly connected to the gold industry at this point, and I can't believe the gold went down in the paper price again today as we're recording this, and there's literally none to be had. So there's a price of gold, but you can't have any at that price. So Jim, I thought a market worked like this. If there's nothing to be had at a price, the price goes up until some appears. Nope. According to Wall Street and COMEX, gold is worth $1,630 an ounce, but you can't get any at that price. So it's just, I always knew this day was coming, and it's just bizarre to find us here with that sort of surreal circumstance at foot.
Well, it might be a good idea to get the real stuff if you can get it and own it rather than the paper stuff. Chris, at one time, especially in the last decade, I think you were looking at peak energy, peak oil. I know I myself was looking at that. Then we got the shale revolution. The U.S. went from producing somewhere around 5 million barrels a day, and I think at our peak we were close to 13. Now, as you mentioned, a lot of those shale companies were heavily leveraged with debt. They're basically zombie companies that were kept alive by credit. A lot of those companies are going to go under here. What's your view on energy from now and the future?
Well, we've never seen demand destruction like we've seen. I've seen estimates as high as 20 million barrels a day of demand destruction for this year. And of course, that makes sense if you look at all the flights not being taken. You look at all those pictures of empty, giant six lanes each direction, boulevards and cities with not a car on them. You can just get a sense of the amount of oil that's not being burned. And oil, of course, is the lifeblood of the economy. So as I see this destruction in oil demand, that's my proxy for understanding just how bad the economic destruction is that's underneath that. You don't have to study every supply chain. Just study the amount of oil that's not being used, and you get a sense of this. As we look at that, I've been following the shale industry for a long time, and it's bothered me the whole time because it's never been a moneymaker, ever. And it's collectively lost lots and lots of money. And, we had to suffer through all this crazy stuff, Jim, or like Wall Street's like, oh, but the break-even's now 40 a barrel. Like, no, because they still have all the debt and equity that they took out before they drilled that new well. And that has to be part of the factor. You can't just zero out all the prior investment and capital and say we're starting fresh. It doesn't work that way. But it might work that way after this happens. So by this, I mean, we're going to see massive destruction of existing equity and debt claims in the shale space. It's going to be an epic. Bankruptcy attorneys are going to be as busy as they've ever been, right? There's going to be a settling that comes out of that. And I do think that there is some worthwhile stuff to pursue in the shale space, but I'm still convinced that they never had $40 a barrel break-evens. I think they were twice that when you add all costs actually in and the true risks. And as well, it wasn't going to be a forever kind of thing anyway, just because, you run out of tier one acreage and, the good stuff gets drilled first and all that, right? So as I look at all of that, I think the demand structure for oil is going to be the big story for years to come, because it's going to take a long time for people's behaviors to come back and start taking those flights around the world and getting on cruise ships and doing all of that stuff. I think that it's just, there's something psychological that happens that takes a good long time to undo. And that's even if, everything kind of goes back to normal. So 9/11, we saw it took years for airline travel to get back to what it was after that. And that was one short, sharp shock. This is very different. This is a much more terrifying sort of a moment, I think, for people psychologically.
As we conclude here, obviously there are events that happen in people's lifetimes, like in my grandparents and parents' time, the Great Depression, World War I, World War II shaped people. My mom collected coupons till the day she died. She wouldn't go to the grocery store without a coupon. So it shaped people's behaviors. As you look out over the next 10 years, how do you see things playing out? I think travel will be more limited. I think people won't go to restaurants as often as they used to. If they do go to restaurants, you're not going to have tables that are bunched up together like they are today. I think this transition that you're going to see that, maybe I don't want to live in New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, cities that are very crowded. I want something a little bit more spacious and a little bit more free room, but also the kind of things that we spend our time on and what works in what I call the next economy.
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the more profound things we can meditate on, which is, what are all those changes going to be? Because this is going to be a huge set of changes that you mentioned. And I think this is going to be a very long time before any of those undo. And, you know, there's nothing's ever just bad. And there's a lot that's not good about this coronavirus. And I wish that, you know, we'd had a more gentle way to get, to this next stage of things. But I think what's important that's coming along here is that people will get a sense of remembering what's really important in life again. That it's our lives, that it's our friends, it's our families, that I'm finding myself, Jim, this is a really weird thing, but I was eating an avocado yesterday, and I had this thought that, what if this is the last avocado I have for a really long time, maybe ever, right? And because of that, I enjoyed it a lot, right? It was suddenly a very precious thing to me, and it was not something I took for granted. So I'm seeing that where this people are not taking things for granted anymore is quite as much, and I think that's good. And as well, I have my own little hope here that. I think a very disconnected government that really became more about corporations and power and not, it became very unconnected from the people to the point that it felt like it had to even lie to its people about something as silly as face masks. Just shows you how bad that got. And I'm hoping that somehow we get a correction on that, that there is a course correction where a lot of these really defunct, I don't even like to call them leaders, I'll call them managers, and they're doing bad management around all the laws and all that. I'm hoping there's a sweep into the House, pox on both of them. That's a man can dream. But I do think that there's a change coming where we're no longer going to put up with stuff that really wasn't serving us. And I got to be honest, our healthcare system, I call it a sick care system, my insurance bills were $22,000 a year for a healthy family, right, as a small business owner. And that was with a bronze plan where you knew that they were going to ding you on everything and you're accidentally going to get out of network and you're going to have to fight every charge. It was just stupid. That whole sick care system, if that burns down and gets rebuilt, that would be a great thing. So I think there's a chance here to really get our arms around some stuff that wasn't working right and finally wake up to that and have the opportunity to reshape them and reform them to things that do serve us. Because that's one thing this virus has been exposing, is how few things really serve the people of this nation versus the corporations and the power structures.
And finally, Chris, as we close, tell our listeners about your website and two books. One was The Crash Course, which is must reading by anybody. And then your second book, Prosper.
Sure. The website is peakprosperity.com. That's P-E-A-K, prosperity.com. And we got a lot of great content there. We have most of our content is free. We also have a subscription newsletter there for people who like to go a little deeper. Great tribe of people. Really, it's more about the community than the website. So it's fantastic. Crash Course covers the big changes that I saw or still see coming around the economy, energy, the environment, looking at all three at once. And that's sort of the problem definition side. It leads to a question, what do I do? And that would be Prosper, which I co-wrote with Adam Taggart. And that takes people through 8 forms of capital that you can build up. Financial capital, really important, probably the biggest chapter in there, but there are other forms of capital that if you build those, and if you had those right now in the face of this pandemic, your life would be happier, more secure, you would be more resilient. And so that's what Prosper is, taking people through a thought process and a journey of how to build 8 forms of capital into their lives.
And I'd highly recommend you go through Chris's Crash Course, and it's in video form and it's free on the site. There's 26 chapters and is must reading. Chris, I want to thank you so much for coming on the program. You're putting out some great stuff. You were early on to this, thank goodness, and you got a lot of information out there. And remember, folks, if you walk away from this with one thing, go get yourself a mask. I don't care if you have to make it, but get one. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Jim. It's been my pleasure.
You bet. And once again, Chris's website is Peak Prosperity, all one word, peakprosperity.com. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.